Please give your kind and careful attention to Brother Jim as he leads us in his class entitled Bethel Remembered Brings Relief. Brother Jim.
Well, thank you, Brother Stephen, and good morning, brethren and sisters and young people. We've come now to have a look at God releasing Jacob from the 40 years that he spent with Laban. And this morning we're going to talk about some of those things that surround his departure from Haran, and of course Laban pursuing him and belittling him as he does in the events that occur at Gilead, the place where they made a covenant. And we're going to see the relevance of that to the story that we've been telling over the course of this weekend. We're going to see the relevance to ourselves. And then finally, in our exhortation this morning, we hope to deal with the great lesson of Jacob's life, the changing of his name in the events at the brook Jabbok, when an angel wrestles with him. It has a very great lesson for us, brothers and sisters, as you will see, God willing. And so, in our studies yesterday, we got to Genesis chapter 31, and we saw that Bethel was remembered by Jacob. And we looked at some of those verses there. I just want to highlight them again, because the point that's being made here, brothers and sisters, is that when Jacob had learned to hate what he saw in Laban, and of course his wages have just been changed 10 times in 6 years, when he had finally thrown away his rods, as we considered at the end of chapter 30, putting no reliance or confidence in his own ability to solve his problems, God said, right, you can go home. And of course the same thing will happen in our life. When we finally put our trust and confidence in our God, when we are conscious of the presence of his angels, we're going to see that Jacob is going to meet those angels he hasn't seen for 40 years. It's a sign from God that he has put his confidence. He doesn't get it right, but he is putting his confidence in the angelic supervision of his life. When we get to that point, God can release us from some of the problems that we've been enduring. We're ready. We're ready to go home, so to speak. And so here he is. And these are the statements that he made. And of course, we saw that great lesson that came out of Genesis 28 verse 15. I will never leave thee, nor forsake thee, until I have done that which I have spoken to thee of. He finally remembers that promise, because now it's very effective in his life. Verse 3, we read, didn't we, that Yahweh said to Jacob, return to the land of thy fathers and to thy kindred, and I will be with thee. That harks back to Genesis 28 and verse 15. But then Jacob, in talking to Rachel and Leah in the field, as we are told in verse 4 of Genesis 31, makes a few very important statements. In verse 5 he says, but the God of my father hath been with me. Now, that's a reference back to verse 3, isn't it? It's taking his mind is going back to Genesis 28 verse 15. God has been with me. He hasn't let me down. He's done what he said he would do. Verse 7. He says, but God suffered Laban not to hurt me. So all of my devices, you know, my rods that I spent a lot of time preparing, all that was useless. It was God who in the end, every time he changed my wages, that's what came out. And so God has taken away the cattle of Laban. And verse 9, thus God hath taken away the cattle of your fathers and given them to me, he could say to his wives. And then in verse 13, we have this statement. I am the God of Bethel. So if you had any doubts at all that this is all about Genesis 28, then there is your answer. I am the God of Bethel. And he takes Jacob right back to that promise that was made in Genesis 28 verse 15. Where thou anointest the pillar, and where thou vowest a vow unto me. Now arise, get thee out from this land, and return unto the land of thy kindred. And Rachel and Leah said, let's go. Our father has taken all that belonged to us. We have nothing. Let's go. But of course, it wasn't quite that simple, because Rachel had a plan. Of course, Laban wouldn't want them to go, and so Jacob had to sneak away. Verse 17. Then Jacob rose up and set his sons and his wives upon camels, and he carried away all his cattle and all his goods which he had gotten, the cattle of his getting, which he had gotten and paid in a ram, for to go to Isaac his father in the land of Canaan. And he did this when Laban was shearing his sheep. See verse 19. Laban went to shear his sheep, and Rachel had stolen the images that were her fathers. Now these images, these teraphim as they are going to play a very important part in the story from now on. So what were teraphim? Well, the discoveries at a place called Nusa, southeast of Nineveh, near modern Kirkuk, in 1925 to 1941, have yielded several thousand cuneiform tablets illustrating such patriarchal customs as the teraphim, referred to here. The latter are known to have been household deities, the possession of which implied family leadership. In the case of the married daughter, they assured the husband the right to the property of her father. So you can begin to see the way that Rachel's mind was working. Now these teraphim are little images that sat up on the mantelpiece over the fireplace. And they were there as a testimony to, you know, certain things. They actually were title deeds. They were really title deeds. Because Unger goes on to say this in his Bible handbook. Since Laban evidently had sons of his own when Jacob left for Canaan, they alone had the right to their father's gods. Accordingly, Rachel stealing the teraphim was a serious offence, aimed at preserving for her husband the chief title to Laban's estate. So that's why Laban chases after Jacob. That's why we're going to read the next portion of Genesis 31. That's why there's a tangle at Jabesh Gilead. We're going to see the issues that arise. These teraphim were not just simply deities or gods. That was a very minor role that they played. Very, very minor role, especially in Laban's family. They were the title deeds to his property. And if you had them, you could claim his property. So that's why Rachel took them. She said out in the field, didn't she? Our father has taken all that belonged to us. See verse 14. Rachel and Leah answered and said unto him, is there any portion or inheritance for us in our father's house? Verse 16. For all the riches which God hath taken from our father, that is ours and our children's. You see, so they felt as though they had been hard done by. Certainly Rachel felt she'd been hard done by Laban, her father. And so she steals his teraphim to secure possession of his title deeds. Well, it's going to go on from there, of course, isn't it? Now, what we have in the record from Genesis 17 to verse 42 is Jacob's final struggle with the Syrian. And this wrestling, you might say, with the Syrian is going to precede the wrestling of Jacob with the angel in Genesis 32. So Laban, finding out, of course, that he's been duped, that his images, his teraphim have been stolen, he chases after Jacob. And verse 23 tells us that. He took his brethren with him, pursued after him 7 days' journey, and they overtook him in the Mount Gilead. And God came to Laban the Syrian in a dream by night and said unto him, take heed that thou speak not to Jacob either good or bad. Now you may have the same margin in your Bible that I have in mine. It says, do not speak from good to bad. Now that's how human beings operate, don't they? You will have had the experience, someone, you know, who's about to give you the axe. It might be that you've been, you know, sacked from your job, or you're about to be sacked from your job. And then they invite you into their office and, you know, they shake hands and say, how are you today? Right? Sit down and, you know, have a cup of tea. And then they hand you a pink slip and get the security to escort you out. You've had that experience? Well, I know brethren who have. So that's going from good to bad. That's using deceptive methods. And so God knows that Laban intends evil for Jacob and his family. What Laban probably was going to do was to kill Jacob, take back his daughters and all the children, and, of course, find his teraphim and return home. There's no doubt that he had evil intentions. Otherwise, God would not have presented himself to this man in the way that he did. He intervenes to ensure that Jacob survives this terrible incident. In verses 25 to 42, we find Laban catches up with Jacob and he interrogates him. He's very angry. He's very suspicious. He is fully convicted that Jacob was the one who stole his teraphim, that Jacob has got his hands on Laban's title deeds, and he's not about to let that happen. In verse 30, we find that he belittles Jacob. Have a look at verse 30 of Genesis 31. In fact, he admits in verse 29, it's in the power, the word is ael, it was in the might of my hand to do you hurt. Yes, he meant to kill him, or at least send him away severely dealt with. But the God of your father spake unto me yesternight, saying, take heed that thou speak not from good to bad. And now, though thou wouldest needs be gone, because thou sore longest after thy father's house, yet wherefore hast thou stolen my teraphim? Now you see what he's doing here? If he can't injure him physically, then he's going to injure him in another way. He's going to insult him. He's going to belittle him. He's saying to Jacob, you know, you want to go home to mummy and daddy, don't you? You know? You want to go back to mummy and daddy. Belittling him. Well, he's been away for 40 years, hasn't he? That's long enough. His mother's dead anyway. He's only got a living father. So, he's belittling him. But he does worse than that. You come down to verse 33. So, see, Jacob says, his retort to Laban is, well, look, if you find these teraphim, he's so confident that they're not in the camp, you find these teraphim, the person who's got them should die. He doesn't know that Rachel's got them, his favourite wife. He wouldn't say that, would he, if he suspected Rachel had them? The person deserved to die. So Laban then proceeds to search. I want you to notice something. This is very, very curious, this verse. Note the order of the search, because it's an index to Laban's character. It says in verse 33, and Laban went into Jacob's tent, and into Leah's tent, into the two maidservants' tents, but he found them not. Then went he out of Leah's tent, and entered into Rachel's tent. Now let me illustrate that to you. Here is an illustration of what the tent encampment might have looked like. So we've got Jacob up here. We have the maidservants next door, because they've got to do some work. We have Rachel, his favourite wife, next, and we have Leah down the end. Alright, so let's just say that that's the way that the camp is set out. So Laban searched for the teraphim. What does he do first? Well, he's suspicious of Jacob. He believes Jacob's got these teraphim. You imagine what he would have done in that area of the tent? Well, we know what he did, because Jacob tells us what he did. Look at verse 37 of Genesis 31. Whereas thou hast searched all my stuff, what hast thou found of all thy household stuff? Set it here before my brethren and thy brethren, that they may judge betwixt us both. Now, that phrase there, searched all my stuff, Rotherham translates it, now that thou hast felt about among all my goods. So, Laban went through everything. He went through his underwear. He went through his socks. And he felt, because he knew the size of the teraphim, he felt everything. There was nothing. A bit like a thief that comes into your house and opens all your drawers and goes through everything. You feel as though you've been, you know, abused, don't you? And Jacob's standing there. Jacob knows that the teraphim are not in there. And he's got Laban, spends probably a couple of hours going around. And more than that, he would have dug up the ground under the tent to make sure that he hadn't buried them. He finds nothing. So what does he do next? Well, verse 33 tells us he goes into Leah's tent. So you see, this is the order of suspicion in Laban's mind. He's got a list of the likely guilty parties. He's done a thorough search of Jacob's tent. Now he goes into Leah's tent. He does a similar thorough search of her tent. So where does he go next? Well, it says in verse 33, he went into the two maidservants' tents. So he's eliminated Jacob and Leah. Now he goes into the maidservants and does another thorough search in their tent. Where does he go next? Well, look at the last sentence of verse 33. Then went he out of Leah's tent and entered into Rachel's tent. Eh? Did I read that correctly? He goes back to Leah's tent. Now what about Rachel? Who would you be most suspicious of? Come on, you had a list of people who could have taken the teraphim. Who would you have been most suspicious of? Well, Rachel would have been on top of my list, wouldn't it? Wouldn't she? Of course she would. So what are we being told here, brothers and sisters? We're being told something about Laban's character. And there's a lesson for us to learn out of this. This is the man that Jacob could say to his wives, "Your father's deceived me a multitude of times, and yet I've never let him down. He's never found me to be anything but trustworthy." Did you see what he said back in the early part of Genesis 31? When he tells his wives that he had served their father with all his heart. He'd given total commitment and service to Laban, even though he was being deceived uphill and down dale. Yes, brethren, it doesn't matter whether you have a bad boss. You must do the right thing whether you've got a good boss or a bad boss. You've got a boss that deceives you, serve him like you would serve God. That's what Paul says, isn't it? Serve him like you would serve God. Well, Jacob had done that. He had good cause to say, "Well, look, why would I want to bother serving this fellow? He's deceiving me and robbing me every second day." Well, he was not serving Laban. He was doing what you and I do when we serve Pharaoh, so to speak. We're actually serving God and Christ. And the way we approach our work out there in the world is extremely important for the maintenance of the righteousness of God, because they'll look at you and say, "He's a Christadelphian, she's a Christadelphian." And if you don't do what we are required to do, then guess what happens? The name of God, the truth, is denigrated. We should be known, like Joseph was known, to be diligent. Whether we're in the house of Potiphar or in the deepest dungeon of Egypt, it does not matter. You get in there and do your absolute best as though you're working for God. Now, that's a very important principle. And so Jacob stands, and he's a little bit miffed by what Laban is doing here. "You've gone through and searched all my stuff." He knows he's honest. And he's confident that he will not find a terror for him. So when he's gone back to Leah's tent, and he searches through there again, it must have tweaked to him when he's in the maid's room. "Well, I didn't look in that box," or whatever. So he's gone back and had another look at Leah. He's suspicious of her. He has no suspicion at all that Rachel is the one. So when he comes into Rachel's tent, look what happens here. Genesis chapter 31, verse 34. Now Rachel had taken the teraphim and put them in the camel's furniture, it's a saddle, and sat upon them. You know, they used to have a box, but they would sit on top of the camel. And that, you know, made riding a camel relatively comfortable, if that's possible. But this box was like a saddle, and there was obviously a vacant area underneath. Now, if you wanted to hide something in your tent, wouldn't that be the most obvious place to put it? Yeah. Does he look there? No. Why not? Well, she makes a lame excuse. Let's read on. Laban, verse 34, searched all the tent but found them not. And Rachel said to her father, "Don't let it displease you, Dad. I cannot rise up before thee, because, you know, the custom of women is upon me." Come on. If your daughter said that to you, would you be deceived by that? No. I'd give her a kick in the backside and say, "Get off that saddle. I want to look under there." Wouldn't you? Well, he doesn't do it. Why not? Well, learn this about human nature, brothers and sisters. Learn this. It is one of the problems we have. We never, ever see wrongdoing in people who are identical to ourselves. That's the lesson. Rachel was a carbon copy of her father Laban. No question about that. And he could not see in her any problem, because she was too much like him. Now, think about your own raising of children. And if you're honest with yourself, the children in your family most like yourself, I'll guarantee you're slightly easier on them. That's the way human nature works. Unless, of course, the truth dominates. If flesh enters into the scene, that's the way it will be. But if the truth dominates, then you'll have an even hand in the way you treat your children. But he didn't have that. He makes a perfunctory search. He accepts a lame excuse, And Rachel, of course, has got the teraphim. She's sitting on them. Well, the story goes on. And Jacob has his say in verses 38 through to 41. In those verses, he says, verse 38, "This 20 years have I been with thee, thy ewes and thy she-goats have not cast their young, and the rams of thy flock have I not eaten. That which was torn of the beasts, I brought it not unto thee, I bear the loss of it. Of my hand didst thou require it, whether stolen by day or stolen by night." That wasn't the common practice, but that's what Laban did, and Jacob accepted. You know, he was being ripped off by his master. Just accepted it. Got on with the job. And it wasn't an easy job. Look at verse 40. "Thus I was in the day the drought consumed me." So it was hot, bitterly hot in the Syrian sun. I've been there, I know that. "And frost by night." As soon as the sun goes down, it's the exact opposite. You know, it's minus something in the nights. You're covered in frost. So he says, "My sleep departed from mine eyes. Thus have I been 20 years in thy house. I served thee 14 years for thy two daughters and 6 years for thy cattle, and you've changed my wages 10 times in that last 6 years." So you see, Jacob puts his case. Now, the question is, was he in Haran for 20 years or 40 years? And of course, it all revolves around this section of verses, doesn't it? I want to give you three proofs that he was there for 40 years. Not that this is, I mean, this is not the end of the world if we don't agree on this matter, but I'm going to give you the proofs so that you can go away with something to think about. 40 is the number of probation, by the way, and Jacob was in Haran to be purged of Assyria. So was he 57 or 77 when he arrived in Haran? Now you can work back with Jacob's life. You know the age he died, 147. You know the age he went to Egypt, 130, and so on. So you can work back in his life. So you know the latter dates of his life. That's not in dispute. So if he was there in Haran for 20 years, then he had to be 77 when he left Beersheba. If he was there for 40 years, then he was 57. So was it 57 or 77 when he left home? Well, the facts are these. Jacob was 15 on the death of Abraham, as we saw yesterday. At that time, Ishmael was 89. Ishmael died when Jacob was 63. Let me get that right. Ishmael died when Jacob was 63. I want to show you the verse that illustrates this. Genesis 28 verse 9. Let's have a look at Genesis 28 verse 9. This is where you remember the story about how Esau, having heard the charge given to Jacob, goes to find a wife from Ishmael. It says this: "Then went Esau unto Ishmael, and took unto the wives which he had Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael, Abraham's son." So is Ishmael alive, or is he not alive? Well, it says he went to Ishmael, doesn't it? So when I read that, I read that Ishmael is alive at that time. True? Well, Ishmael died when Jacob was 63. So you see, Jacob could not have been 77 when he left, because this incident occurs when he left to go to Haran. When he left, Esau went to Ishmael. So if Jacob's 77, I'm sorry, Ishmael was dead. Because Ishmael died when Jacob and Esau were 63. So it has to be 57. There's no other way of understanding that. So there's the first indication, the first proof. And here's the second one. There are two verses important here, but the word that is used to start these verses is the same. Genesis chapter 31, verse 38. We read, "This 20 years." That refers to the time that Jacob spent as a friend, as a son-in-law, in the house of Laban after he had already served 14 years for his two wives. But then we got verse 41. "Thus have I been 20 years in thy house. I served thee 14 years for thy two daughters and 6 years for thy cattle." This refers to the time that he spends labouring for his wives and the cattle. So this is how it works out. He worked for Rachel 7 years, for Leah 7 years, He sojourned as a friend. This section, this 20 years, was here, in the middle. And then, when he wanted to go home, Laban said, no, you nominate your wages. And so he worked for 6 years to finish off his service. A total of 40. Now, the word that is used here twice is this word Z. See it up there?
Z-E-H.
You find that in the English word in verse 38, this. This 20 years. You find it again in verse 41. Thus have I been 20 years. So the this of verse 38 and the thus in the Hebrew of verse 41 is the same Hebrew word. And this is what Clark has to say in his commentary. Now the 20 concurrent years of neighbourly assistance and the disjointed 20 of covenant service seem both of them distinguished in the history itself. For upon Laban's pursuit of Jacob, he mentions 20 years twice, which two sets of 20, if really different, make 40. Each mention of the 20 years is introduced with the word Z. Which word, when repeated, is used by way of distinction? As when we say, in our parlance, this and that. Or, that one and the other. The one and the other. Now that's how we speak, isn't it? You want to point out two distinct things? That, this and that. That's how the Hebrew word is used throughout the Old Testament. It is there to make a distinction. So when this word precedes the two references to 20 years, it's telling us there were two distinct periods of 20 years. Well then, that's the second proof. Now, by this stage, and I've done this many times, by this stage I'm looking out at the audience and there are people saying, oh yeah, okay, you know, maybe. Well, now comes the sledgehammer, right? Number three. So if you're doubters, think about this. All right, here it comes. Why 20 years has got to be too short? Jacob had no children until at least the 8th year that he was in Haran. True? He had to work 7 years for Rachel. He got Leah and then he got Rachel in a week. And a child couldn't have been born to Leah until at least probably 12 months later. Because she didn't get a look in for a while, did she? So we're being generous. Reuben born, maybe the 8th year that he's in Haran. Agree? It's got to be that way. So Reuben, the eldest, would have been 12 years of age on re-entry to the land of Canaan. This is the son of Jacob who went in to Bilhah, Rachel's maid. He probably would have been about 16 when that happened. Well, it can happen. 16-year-olds can get into trouble, can't they? I don't think so. Simeon and Levi, who came after Reuben, murdered the men of Shechem. They would have been about 11 and 10 years of age. Well, I've seen 11 and 10-year-olds wielding sticks and trying to hit each other over the head. But I doubt whether 11 and 10-year-olds could butcher 300 or 400 men. True? And the earliest that Dinah could have been born was 18 years after Jacob's arrival in Haran. This would make her about 2 or 3 years old when she went to visit the daughters of the land and was defiled by Shechem, the prince of the city. Possible? Don't think so. So it cannot be 20 years. It is an absolute impossibility. It has to be 40. So the two previous explanations give you the ground upon which you can make a sound decision about that matter. Not that it really matters at the end of the day. Look, if you go to the judgment seat believing it's 20 and I go there believing 40, I don't think either of us will be rejected. All right? It's not critical. But it's one of those things that, you know, I'm one of those people. I like to get things right. So do you. Get it right. And you can get it right. So let's finish this off before we have our cup of coffee. Because we've got the end of Genesis 31. You see what happens here? Laban's done his search, and the time comes for him to depart. He hasn't found the teraphim. And we read of what happens. Verse 44. Now therefore, and by the way, if you read verse 43, he's an angry man. He's a really angry man. These are my daughters. They're my children. He's angry. In verse 44, he says, now therefore come thou, let us make a covenant, I and thou, and let it be for a witness between me and thee. So Jacob took a stone, he set it up for a pillar. He's done this before, hasn't he? He did this at Bethel, the first time. Sets it up for a pillar. But he doesn't pour any oil on the top of this one. Jacob said unto his brethren, you gather stones, and they took stones, and they made a heap, and they ate there a meal on that heap. Laban called it Jegar Sa-Hadutha. Now, Jegar Sa-Hadutha, of course, has the idea of a place of a cone of witness. That's why he called it that. So, we read on that Jacob calls it something else. He called it Galeed, which simply means witness. And Laban said, this heap is a witness between me and thee this day. Therefore was the name of it called Galeed. And Mizpah, for he said, Yahweh watch between me and thee when we are absent one from another. If thou shalt afflict my daughters, or if thou shalt take otherwise beside my daughters, no man is with us. See, God is witness betwixt me and thee. And Laban said to Jacob, he's oozing with hypocrisy. Absolutely oozing with hypocrisy. He has got no intentions of making any covenant with Jacob himself. He is only interested in getting out of Jacob's mouth a binding covenant that will stop Jacob coming across that point with the teraphim to claim Laban's property. There's only one thing in his mind, preservation of his materialism. That's what he's got in mind. Verse 52. This heap be witness, that this pillar be witness, that I will not pass over this heap to thee, that thou shalt not pass over this heap and this pillar unto me for harm. Don't you dare bring the teraphim back, Jacob. Don't you dare. And he says this, verse 53. The God of Abraham and the God of Nahor, the God of their father, judge betwixt us. So that's what Laban said. He calls upon the God of Abraham and the God of Nahor, and the God of their father. But look what the next sentence says in verse 53. And Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac. Now think about this. Here we've got this hypocrite, this materialistic man who's only interested in preserving his goods from possible attack from Jacob. And we've got a man who served him all his days for 40 years with honesty and integrity because he feared God. What a difference between these two men. Now this word fear, pekad, means dread or terror. Rotherham says dread. So Jacob swore by the dread of his father Isaac. You know, Psalm 76 verses 11 and 12 make this statement. Vow and pay unto Yahweh your God. Let all that be round about him bring presents unto him that ought to be feared. There's the Hebrew word. There's the Hebrew word that is used here in verse 53. Pekad, in that psalm. He shall cut off the spirit of princes. He is terrible to the kings of the earth. Well, Jacob was of that mind. He feared the God of his father Isaac. Now, Abraham was dead, but Isaac was still alive. So this is all about integrity before God. And that was the real issue between Jacob and Laban. You know, brothers and sisters, there's a very real lesson in that for you and me. We live in a world of dishonesty, where people are wholly given to the preservation of their materialistic goods, the preservation of their possessions and their bank accounts. It's all about to go down the gurgler. And the greatest depression that this world has ever seen. And Christ says that he's got a fear. He has a real fear. And it comes through Luke 17. Remember Lot's wife. It comes through Revelation 3. Laodicea. Behold, he says to them, I stand at the door and knock, because they represent the final generation of Christadelphians. What was their problem? Rich and increased with goods, having need of nothing. They wanted to hang on to what they had in the present, like Lot's wife did. That's going to be the test. But if we are people of integrity and honesty, if we are people like Jacob, we're not really interested. We have faith. We fear the God of Isaac. We don't care whether the world takes our stuff, do we? We don't care about that. We're only concerned with what's beyond. That's the spirit that Jacob had. He was now fully in the hands of his God. We said Gilead signifies a witness heap. Jegesahadutha, the Aramaic or Chaldean, means a witness heap. Mizpah signifies a watchtower. So Laban's objective in this is to draw a line in the sand over which Jacob could not cross with the teraphim, the title deeds to his property, to claim Laban's assets. So finally now, in the last few minutes of our session here this morning, I want to just have a brief look at a couple of the things that arise out of the early part of Genesis 32. Because we read at the end of verse 55 of Genesis 31 that early in the morning Laban rose up, he kissed his sons and his daughters, he blessed them, and Laban departed and returned unto his place. Yes, his place was Syria. That's where he belonged. What it says in the next verse, chapter 32, verse 1. And Jacob went on his way. Yes, he's going back to the land of promise. And guess what happens? As soon as Laban's departed from him, he sees the angels that he saw at Bethel. He hasn't seen them for 40 years. 40 long years. And in verse 1, he goes on his way, and the angels of God met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said, this is God's host. He said that back in Genesis 28, didn't he? And he called the name of that place Mahanaim. Now, Mahanaim signifies two camps. And he's wrong again. He should never have named it Mahanaim. He's wrong. He doesn't have two camps. That's the whole point of Genesis 28. When the angels of God ascending and descending upon him, he's only got one camp, hasn't he? Like you and me. There is only one camp. But you see, he hasn't quite got this right. They were already there. They'd never left him, in fact. You know, Psalm 34, verse 7 says, the angel of Yahweh encampeth round about them that fear him. We just had a declaration that Jacob feared God. And delivereth them. He's just delivered him from the hand of Laban. So there aren't two camps, Jacob. There's only one. You know, it took 147 years for Jacob to finally come to the realisation that there was only one camp. And when he stood before Pharaoh, Genesis 48, verse 16, the final realisation came. And when he stood with his son Joseph and his two sons, his two grandsons, he could make this confession. After a lifetime of experience, finally came to the realisation that the angels he saw at Bethel had been with him the whole time. It's just that he wasn't conscious of it all the time. The angel which redeemed me from all evil, he could say. Genesis 48, verse 16. And that's the case with you and me, brothers and sisters, isn't it? Paul says in Hebrews 2:14, are they not all ministering spirits sent forth to minister for them who shall be heirs of salvation? Yes, they are. Be conscious. Be conscious of the angel ascending, descending upon you. I'm not always conscious of it. So I'm like Jacob. It's going to take me a while to come to the full realisation of that. There's a lesson in that. And here's another one. He's presented with the problem of Esau. Look at verse 4. Verse 3, perhaps. Genesis 32. And Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau his brother unto the land of Seir. And back they come. They have a message. Yeah, he's coming. Verse 6. The messengers returned to Jacob saying, We came to thy brother Esau, and he cometh to meet thee with 400 men. 400 men? Jacob's mind immediately says, oh no, he's bringing an army to kill me. But Esau wasn't bringing an army to kill him, as we find out. So why do you want to bring 400 men? Well, because Esau's a man of the flesh. He's got ego. Because the messengers of Jacob have gone down and they've said to Esau, you know your brother who left 40 years ago, he had a staff in his hand. Well, he's coming back. He's got four wives. He's got 11 sons, one daughter. He's got millions, thousands of animals of all kinds. And Esau's little mind says, oh, Jacob's done pretty well for himself, hasn't he, in his absence? But so have I. And so, when I go up to meet him, I'll take 400 men with me. And he will be extremely impressed that his older brother has done just as well as Jacob's done. See the mind of Esau? It's a little bit like you see sometimes. I mean, we've got this problem of trying to keep up with the Joneses. So if Brother X buys himself a new Lexus and parks it in the ecclesial car park, the weak-minded Brother Y says, look at my bummy old car alongside of his. So he goes and buys a Mercedes and parks it next to the brother with a Lexus. You don't reckon that happens? Ego, human pride, is our greatest enemy, brothers and sisters. And the judgment seat is going to prove to be, alongside of ignorance, one of the greatest killer of Christadelphians of all time. Ignorance has done a lot of damage. But pride can destroy knowledgeable men, like Ahithophel's, remember him? Like King Asa of Judah, greatest reformer in Judah's history. Even Hezekiah suffered because of pride. When the Babylonians came, he wanted to show them everything he had in his kingdom. And God said, you're an idiot. Human pride is one of our greatest enemies. That's why I believe it's number 3 in the list. 1 John 2 verses 15 and 16. Lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes. Now, I still have trouble with those two. Doubtless you do too. But not like I used to have. Nowhere like I used to have. But I tell you what, I'm still grappling with number 3. The pride of life. So this is a little indication of where Esau stood in the scheme of things. Full of pride. But then what does Jacob do? Well, he's very distressed. Look at verse 7. When Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people that was with him. Never good counsel to divide those who are with you. Never good policy to divide those who are with you. I'll say no more than that. He goes on to say this. And he divided them into two camps. So now he's got three camps, hasn't he? He's at Mahanaim. He thinks there are two camps. His camp, the angel's camp. He takes his own camp, separates it. He's got two camps in his own camp. He's now got three camps. Not good policy. But then he takes out an insurance policy, verse 8. And he said, if Esau come to the one company and smite it, then the other company which is left shall escape. Hardly likely when he's got 400 men. You see what he's doing here? He takes out an insurance policy to mitigate the loss. But then in verse 9, he delivers one of the greatest prayers of the Bible. There's only one problem with it, brothers and sisters. He doesn't get it in the right order. When he heard of Esau coming, the first thing he should have done was to pray. And then he might have had a bit more sense in what he did thereafter. But he didn't pray. When the crisis came, he did not pray. He used his own machinations, his own mind, to save himself from his own predicament. Now, we wouldn't be like this, would we? We'd never take out insurance policies and then pray. No, we wouldn't do that. But Jacob did. So we've got to learn a lesson. You know, the prayer is not immediately answered. And there's a reason for that. Because he hasn't got around the right way. It's not immediately answered. But it is ultimately answered. So the governing principle of this, brothers and sisters, as we lead into our exhortation this morning, is in John chapter 6, verses 28 and 29. When Christ was presented with a multitude who came to have their bellies filled, remember them? John 6? They didn't come to hear him preach. They didn't come because of the signs to understand what he was doing. They came to have their bellies filled. And they said to him, Lord, what shall we do that we might do the works of God? His answer was very simple. This is the work of God. That you believe on him whom he has sent. Mankind is like Jacob. We're all like Jacob. What can I do? Got a problem? What can I do? What can I do? Isn't that what we're like? We're going to solve our own problems with our own ingenuity, our own brain power, and then we think about praying. That's what man's like. What can I do that I might do the works of God? They asked. You want to do the work of God? Well, let him work. Let him work. Believe on him whom he has sent. And then get about your business and you'll do it with a lot more intelligence than if you act first and then pray. It was Yahweh who would ransom, as we read in Jeremiah 31 verse 11, it was he who would ransom Jacob from the hand of him that was stronger than he. And one final comment. You know, we read in Genesis 32 that when he sent his messengers, in verse 4, when Jacob sent his messengers, he commanded them, saying, thus shall you speak unto my Lord Esau. That phrase is repeated over and over again in chapter 32 and in chapter 33. It's worth highlighting it. Look what happens in chapter 33, verse 8. We read this, and he said, what meanest thou by all this grove which I met, says Esau? And Jacob said, these are to find grace in the sight of my Lord. Verse 13, my Lord knoweth. Verse 14, let my Lord, I pray thee. You know, when he stole the stolen blessing was, your brother will bow down to you, and you'll be Lord over your brethren. You know what Jacob's doing? Deliberately doing? He's giving the stolen blessing back to Esau. He's saying to Esau, he can't miss the point, Esau, you're my Lord. You remember that blessing that I stole? I don't want it. And that's why I sent those five droves with thousands of animals in them. I don't want the blessings of the earth. You know the blessing I stole? Well, I don't want that. Here, you have it. He's giving it back, brothers and sisters. Because it wasn't the blessing that he really wanted. In our exhortation this morning, we're going to see the end of this journey from Jacob to Israel. And it's a really painful journey.